importance of honoring those who have fought for freedom, past, present, and future.
Hi, this is Shepard Ferry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is People Powered Radio.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Labor sociologist Barry Eidlin is back with us today to discuss the recent Air Canada strike, which has just settled. The airline workers, organized in the Canadian Union of Public Employees, went on strike on Saturday, August 16, and is usually the case in Canada. The government ordered the strikers back to work 12 hours later. The flight attendants defied the government order to go back to work, and after an all-night negotiating session, reached a settlement to the strike by August 19th. It's a great example of what labor can do when it doesn't back down. Barry's here to explain the strike, the government response, its outcome, and what it portends. And we'll also talk about Canadian labor law and how it differs from labor law in the United States and disputes when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman with Barry Eidlin. We're talking about the recent Air Canada flight attendant strike. That strike began with 10,000 flight attendants walking off the job after months of failed negotiations. And as expected, the government quickly issued a back-to-work order under Section 107 of the Canada Labor Code. That's a provision that ostensibly regulates strikes, but is instead used to short-circuit them. But this time, something unusual happened. The workers refused to comply. Defying the order, they held firm, chanting, "Forced to fly, we won't comply." And after an all-night bargaining session, they secured, I guess, a tentative agreement showing what labor can do when it doesn't back down. So to help us understand the significance of this whole strike, both for Air Canada workers and for Canadian labor as a whole, I'm joined by Barry Eidlin. He's an associate professor of sociology at McGill University and author of Labor and the Class Idea in the United States and Canada, which came out in 2019 and which we talked about right here. His work focuses on the divergent paths of working class power in the two countries, and he has been closely following this strike and its aftermath. He wrote an op-ed on the use of Section 107, and that was published in the August 18th Globe and Mail in Toronto. So welcome back to the show, Barry. I should just let the listeners know that you often sit in for me. So reversing roles yet again as the guest.
The tables are turned. It's great to be back.
Thank you so much. So let's just, you know, start with the events themselves. What happened with the Air Canada strike? How unusual was it for the workers to openly defy a government back-to-work order?
Yeah, so you gave the timeline. There was it's obviously preceded by months of negotiations. They've been negotiating since the beginning of this year. But then last week, there was a 72-hour strike notice, at which point Air Canada management issued a press release just saying, we're walking away from the table, bargaining is an impasse. We call on the government to invoke a Section 107 back to work order. They let the 72-hour period go to waste. The workers did go on strike on Saturday morning, just before 1 a.m. And before noon, what was previously known as the Minister of Labor, now they insist on calling her the Minister of Jobs and Families for some reason.
That's a bad title.
But the labor minister, I'll still call her the labor minister, basically did what the company was asking them to do, invoked Section 107. This is a novel interpretation of Section 107 of the Canada Labor Code. It's been on the books for a while, but it's only been in the last few years that we've seen the Canadian federal government resort to this novel interpretation of Section 107 to order workers back to work. It was first used on the rail when the Teamsters were on strike, but then when port workers went on strike on the West Coast and in Montreal and Quebec City, it was used again. last year. It was almost used with Air Canada pilots, with WestJet, another Canadian airline, you know, mechanics. And so it became this pattern in the past few years. And it's probably good to talk about the mechanism here.
Can we just go back for 1 second before
You
do? Because I just wanted to, for our listeners, first clarify that it's Air Canada. And so the union are public sector workers. This is owned by the state. It's not a private.
Actually not, no.
All right,
no.
Explain that for us first. Yeah,
so yeah. So for a long time, it was what's called a Crown Corporation, but then it was privatized. So it is a private company. But
the workers are part of the public
workers
sector.
Workers are part of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, but they just are not public employees.
So going to go back and talk about this novel use now of 107, and I think in your op-ed you talked about it as a crutch for both employers and the government. So go ahead and explain that for us.
First of all, it's just important to understand what it actually does. So it allows the labor minister to contact or to refer a case to the Canada Industrial Relations Board, which then does a brief investigation, decides whether or not bargaining is at an impasse. And if they decide that it is, they can then refer the case to binding arbitration. And while the binding arbitration is resolved, the workers are supposed to go back to work and operations are to resume. So basically what the labor minister can do is basically just send an email to the Canada Industrial Relations Board saying, look into this case, and then they can recommend sending the issue to binding arbitration. And according to this interpretation of the law, of the code, Canada Industrial Relations Board, the CIRB, is supposed to grant extreme deference to the labor minister. So basically the labor minister, they're supposed to basically do whatever the labor minister tells them to do. And this is basically a way to make an end run around the traditional way of trampling workers' collective bargaining rights, which is to order special back-to-work legislation, which has the disadvantage of, you know, you need to actually get parliament together. You need to actually draft some legislation. You actually have to have a debate. You have to have a vote on it. And this is not only a hassle, but it is also a lot more of a challenge for governments as of 2015, because in 2015, the Canada Supreme Court issued a ruling called Saskatchewan Federation of Labour v. Saskatchewan, which declared that the right to strike is a constitutionally protected right under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
So this was a backlash to the constant use of this 107?
No, this was not. The 2015 ruling was separate from, this is when they still was in the era of back-to-work legislation. The Section 107 stuff is really only in the past 2 years that we've started to see that. Okay. And it's because the problem now is that if a government wants to issue back-to-work legislation, they have to do something wonky that's called invoking the notwithstanding clause. So the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms has a clause in it that basically says there are certain times when you can circumvent this document, and it's called the notwithstanding clause. It's an escape hatch, but it obviously creates a higher bar for governments to do that. And this Section 107 thing basically provides this bureaucratic end run around having to deal with all the legislative finer points.
So at this time, when they invoked the 107 and go back to work, they did not have to go to Parliament and do all the stuff that you just said. They
could just literally just sending an email to the Canada Industrial Relations.
Wow. So you've argued that, well, of course, the right to strike is the fulcrum, I think you said, of the entire collective bargaining system. So maybe you need to, for our listeners, talk about how, I guess, willy-nilly, the Canadian government has been able to both assert that right and take it away at the same time. So easily.
Yeah. So what I talk about in the op-ed is the right to strike is the sort of fulcrum of the whole collective bargaining system. And that's basically, for negotiations to happen, we have to have something resembling a level playing field.
Yeah.
Obviously, listeners to Beneath the Surface and Jacobin Radio will know that the capitalist class always has a structural advantage over workers, but you need something approaching a level playing field. And bosses have a lot of levers at their disposal to exert power over their workers. And workers basically have one, which is the power to withdraw their labor, to go on strike. And so anything that undermines or somehow gets in the way of workers being able to exercise that right has the effect of skewing the playing field in the boss's favor. And this is a problem even for governments, and ultimately one might argue for the long-term interest of bosses. And governments sort of in Canada found this out the hard way, in that basically they sort of would say, yeah, I think labor rights are a good thing. You know, these are sort of liberal governments, right? So they're in the middle of the road. They're not anti-union. So like the conservatives, when they were in power in the 1930s, there was a similar labor upheaval to what we saw in the United States. But the government's response, rather than Roosevelt's response of giving them the New Deal, you know, the Prime Minister, R.B. Bennett, vowed to crush the workers under the iron heel of ruthlessness. This was a big speech that he gave. So we're talking about liberal governments who sort of are saying, yes, you know, workers need rights and so on, you know, but then when workers would go on strike, their response would be like, oh, well, we can't have that. We need industrial peace. So we're just going to order them back to work. And they would basically just create more and more restrictions on workers' ability to strike and get more and more repressive. And it just kept on backfiring. And it would just create more unrest, which the government was not happy with. And they finally realized that you had to have basically two things. You had to have a means of compelling employers to go to the bargaining table. So the law had to sort of like provide some compulsion. And you also had to have workers able to compel employers through the right to strike. So you basically had to put the scale on the side of workers to a certain degree in the labor policy. You couldn't just sort of say, okay, we love collective bargaining, we love workers' rights, let's just get together and put these deals together. In order for that collective bargaining to work, you had to actually have some coercion built in. And so that's where that came from. But yes, but you had this sort of pattern over time. And there's a great book by Leo Panitch and Donald Swartz called From Consent to Coercion that your readers should look at if they want to dig into this, where basically over the post-war era, particularly starting in the 1970s, the post-war era, basically everybody agreed across the political spectrum that labor rights are good, that collective bargaining is good, unions are good. But then when strikes would happen, they'd be like, yes, we are firm believers in collective bargaining and the right to strike and so on and so forth, except for this once.
Right.
And this, for whatever reason, like this is too economically costly. There are too many damages to the public. Whatever reason, we can't have it this once. But the problem is this once became like almost every time. And so this is what Panitch and Swartz refer to as permanent exceptionalism.
Before we go deeper into that, that sort of takes us right back to what happened this time. Because in this case, it seems, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the government was so certain, you know, that it was almost like a rote response. Okay, they went on strike, we're going to invoke this, you have to go back to work.
Yeah.
And it seems that Air Canada management admitted, this is from your op-ed, that they didn't even have a plan if the union refused to comply. So what does that tell us about how this system evolved?
That goes back to this idea of the crutch, right? When you take away the right to strike or when you undermine it, you shift expectations on the employer side and it eliminates or at least greatly reduces their incentive to actually come to the table and reach an agreement. You saw that this time where you had the CEO of Air Canada being interviewed by Bloomberg News and he was asked, you know, like, didn't you have a plan, like a contingency plan if workers went on strike because, you know, all these customers are up in arms and they're stranded all over the world. And
how many flights did they cancel, by the way? Just everything?
I don't know, but it's rough, you know, it's like 700 flights a day, I believe.
So, huge disruption.
Yeah, huge disruption, right? Like, you know, tens of thousands of passengers that are getting impacted here. He basically said, well, you know, I mean, we just thought that they were going to pull a Section 107 and get the workers back to work. And we didn't expect the union to not comply. And so, no, we didn't have a contingency plan. So it shows how if you have a credible strike threat, that 72-hour notice in a normal situation should provide the pressure on the employer to actually come to the table and actually reach an agreement. And here we saw the rational response of the management class to previous government action, where every other government action in the past 2 years has been to order workers back to work. So why should it be any different this time? And so we're going to adjust our behavior accordingly, and we're not going to bargain because we're just going to wait for the government to order them back to work, and then we'll just get it dealt with through binding arbitration.
So this is really good. And I want to go back in a minute to what you were starting to say about Leo Panitch and Donald Schwartz's permanent exceptionalism.
Yeah.
But there, I also want you to talk a little bit, you hinted at it, about how this conflict traces back to the 1940s, because I think for our listeners, it'll be very useful to understand how labor law diverged from what happened in the United States. But first, let's just talk about whether or not the Canadian Union of Public Employees, that were the flight attendants, thank you, you know, refused to comply. Do you think that that might, you know, signal the end of this exceptionalism, or at least its limits?
That's going to be a key question, right? So QP bucked the trend, right? Because the other unions involved went along with this novel interpretation. I mean, they filed a Supreme Court challenge, but QP workers were basically saying, we're done with this. This is an unconstitutional response, which is what the other union said. But they basically said, our constitutional right to strike is more important and more legal than this novel interpretation of this arcane provision of the Canada Labor Code, and bucked the trend. So they are different in this Section 107 era, but they're not different when you look at the broad sweep of Canadian labor history, and, you know, U.S. labor history for that matter, in that to the extent that U.S. or Canadian or any other workers for that matter have any substantial rights today, it's because previous generations of workers broke the law and changed the law, right? So there are many instances throughout Canadian labor history of Canadian workers refusing back to work injunctions, you know, going to jail, getting roughed up by the Mounties that your listeners might know from like Dudley Do-Right cartoons, but they're actually, you know,
Royal Canadian actually much, Mounted Police.
A bit meaner than that. Yeah.
You did say that, you know, back in the 1940s, this labor upsurge that, you know, was so important in the United States and led to the New Deal as a sort of concession, but did not in Canada, I forgot what you call it, the iron hand or the
iron heel.
Iron heel.
Wrong extremity.
Yes. Right. What happened there? And because that wasn't that also a liberal government, or was that a...
Well, the Iron Heel was the Conservatives. But the formation of the Canadian labor regime, which was modeled after the U.S. National Labor Relations Act, only emerged a decade after the U.S. labor regime, or years, in 1944.
And I was asking because it's, you know, this worldwide surge, in a way, of labor that occurred at the same time. And then, as you explain, and you do it in your book as well, by the 60s and 70s, you get... again, another period of worldwide radicalism and labor upsurge. So can you sort of encapsulate that for the listeners so that they can understand what happened and how it changed in Canada from the Iron Heel to this other system?
A stronger labor, more protective labor regime. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the crux of the book that I wrote about this, which is why are unions weaker in the U.S. than they are in Canada, but haven't always been that way. And then the sort of ironic answer is that it was the long-term effect of these different ruling party responses to the worker upsurge of the 30s and 40s. And what's ironic about it is that it was actually the more pro-union response in the U.S. that ultimately led to labor's weakness, whereas the more repressive response in Canada led to a stronger, more protective labor regime. The reason for that is this process that I was referring to earlier of governments learning the hard way what happens when they try to crack down on labor, which is that it backfires. And so after 10 years of trying to essentially tighten the screws on worker revolt, it basically got to a point in the midst of World War II in 1943, where the government's efforts to contain labor revolt were backfiring so badly that it was impeding the Canadian government's ability to prosecute World War II. And it was leading to a surge of popular support for what was then called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the CCF, which is a precursor to today's New Democratic Party, or NDP. I was on the show with Ed Broadbent, a sort of famous leader of the NDP a few years ago. So this combination of strike waves, wartime strike waves, impeding the government's ability to prosecute the war, and the electoral threat to the left of the Liberals finally got them to cave and come to the table and come out with a policy that actually protected labor rights, compelled employers to engage in collective bargaining, established but tightly regulated the right to strike, you know, created certain rules around union security. So basically established what we recognize as a sort of modern labor regime. But at that point, it looks very similar to what you have in the US. It's literally cut and paste from the National Labor Relations Act in a lot of places. And in many cases is actually worse, more restrictive in terms of how you certify unions, how you sort of are able to go on strike. So it looks very similar, but the key difference is the sort of governing policy goal, essentially, right? And the governing policy goal in the US is basically articulating a set of rights for workers. Whereas in Canada, the overarching goal is to contain labor conflict. And the reason that that matters over the course of the post-war era is that this rights framework in the US opens the door for other parties to claim their rights, namely employers. Right. So you start having moves for things like employer free speech rights or the ability to decertify unions. I mean, you have a right to decertify in Canada, but there's this governing framework of needing to balance competing sets of rights. Right. Mm-hmm. So we need to balance labor rights, these rights that we proclaim in this law. And we also need to consider employer property rights, employer free speech rights, et cetera, et cetera. And that concern with balance creates the conditions for the erosion of labor law in the US. Because whenever you go to the courts and you have some set of rights that are going up against employer property rights, it's a pretty fair bet that property rights win.
Almost always.
Almost always, right?
Yeah.
So that creates a dynamic where employer rights essentially erode, chip away at the substance of the law. So that even though the letter of the law has only changed twice since the initial law, the National Labor Relations Act, you have Taft-Hartley in 47 and you have Landrum-Griffin in 59, the substance of the law is eviscerated through legal interpretation.
Exactly.
Whereas in Canada, the dynamic is very different because of that overall governing framework of wanting to contain industrial conflict. And what that means is that it's not that rights are irrelevant or anything like that, but there's a much more flexible approach from all parties, right? So all parties, even people who are anti-union, even conservatives, they're basically like, we want a functioning collective bargaining system. We want something that works. And so you have a dynamic in the post-war era where the sort of eruption of industrial conflict will often in the near term result in these repressive responses. But then there's a process of policy learning that kicks in where people sort of revisit the issue and they're basically like, okay, so they basically view the conflict as a policy failure because that's their goal is containing industrial conflict. So you get conflict. What went wrong? And then they figure out, okay, well, we need to tweak the law in some way. And so they tweak the laws and in ways that strengthen the protection of worker rights. So you get things in the 70s, even into the 80s, like card check recognition, like first contract arbitration.
Things that we're still struggling for.
Anti-scab legislation. And this comes from the experiences of strikes. So strikes provide a catalyst for policy learning from Canadian federal and provincial governments in a way that doesn't happen in the U.S. context.
This is so interesting. So because in the United States, as you know, labor law has been eviscerated. And when workers go out on strike, they do so with their hands tied behind their back because of labor law here in the United States. Yet they still go out. And it's really pretty interesting because you're talking about how in Canada, labor strife, let's say, has led to progressive policy reforms. Mm-hmm. So, but in the United States, it's usually met with repression or rollback. So, you know, we went back all the way to the 40s and then up through the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And in both countries, by the way, we should say that public sector workers have had a tenuous history in terms of being able to strike, but they got it in Canada. They fought for the right to strike. Politicians reluctantly recognized it. And then, you know, you've got this response by Canadian government and employers, which is to use this provision, which just rolls back the strike anyway. So I guess the question is whether or not you think that this Air Canada strike is going to be a catalyst for more reform in Canada,
because it goes
to policy. Yeah.
That's the really key question, right? You know, whether it would have been possible for workers to defy long enough to get a commitment from the government to overturn. I mean, these are things that we'll be debating. But yes, I mean, I think that there was a policy learning process in the 1960s, right? I reference in the op-ed this quote from Lester B. Pearson, who's maybe somewhat ironically, the Toronto airport is named after the guy now. When postal workers were sort of leading the way for public sector unionization in the 1960s, there was talk of recognizing public sector workers' right to collectively bargain. And of course, the debate, like there was in the US, was about whether or not they should get private sector style collective bargaining rights, which included the right to strike. And there was it was enormously contentious at the time. And both amongst business and the public and in the legislature, there was huge debates. And there was Pearson was writing to another legislator who was complaining about, you know, saying we cannot have public sector workers with the right to strike. And his response was that, and I'm quoting here, if civil servants are to be told under law that they can never strike, one may be precipitating the very thing one is trying to prevent.
Great quote.
So so that is a great capsule summary of how these liberal governments had viewed this thing. And with this liberal government use of Section 107, this was sort of like the crux of my argument in the op-ed, it seemed that they were forgetting the lesson of their liberal predecessors. And so what we're going to see now is, do we see a similar dynamic of policy learning for the liberals this time around, right? Or do they continue, right? And we're going to get another chance to see this in action pretty soon because of Canada Post, which is still not resolved their dispute after the government invoked Section 107 late last year.
So they're still out or what?
They're not out. So they were ordered back to work late last year during the holidays. There was a whole industrial inquiry commission that was struck that issued a report. Canada Post management tabled what they said was their last, best and final offer. The labor minister basically forced a vote on this employer offer that was roundly rejected by 2/3 or more, I think, of the CUPW workers. And so now there's are back to negotiating. But the dynamic there is so poisoned by this repeated use of Section 107 that it's unclear whether Canada Post management will take a strike threat seriously and actually come to some sort of deal. But then on the other hand, it's also unclear whether the Liberal government will exercise more caution and discretion, perhaps, in its use of Section 107 after QP's defiance of the law, because they've now shown that actually you can defy this thing. You don't have to just obey the Canada Industrial Relations Board order. This is actually a lot grayer area. It's not so cut and dry whether this is actually unlawful. And we can push the issue and actually win some gains.
Wow. Let me ask you one question, because it's unusual that the workers defied the order. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously going to be an example. And as you know, we've just talked about, Barry Eidlin, that it could lead to more policy reform. Can you tell us a little bit about the union itself? And is it more militant than it had been? Does it have new leadership? Who are the workers in there? And does it sort of tally with the kind of, you know, increased militancy that we've seen in the last several years in the United States as well?
I mean, QP has a history of militancy. It comes out of the 1960s. It is a public sector union. So it really was forged in the flames of the 1960s worker revolt that organized the public sector. In Canada, you know, public sector unionization rates are close to 80%.
Wow.
So it's not just QP. It's a bunch of different unions. But QP is the largest. And so they have been, you know, on the front lines of a lot of major labor conflicts. I think, you know, the other major one that they've been a part of recently was in 2022, when 55,000 education support workers across Ontario went on strike, and there actually did face back-to-work legislation from the Doug Ford government, and also defied it and got the rest of the Ontario labor movement behind them to threaten a general strike. And within a few days, Doug Ford had backed down and they ended up repealing their back-to-work legislation. This isn't unusual for QP, but it's also part of a broader trend in Canada that's been, you know, like in the U.S. I mean, the sort of what was called initially the summer of strikes and then the seasons of strikes and, you know, the broad
labor's
worker,
hot summer.
Yeah, whatever. You know, that's been going on for a couple of years has been a big thing in Canada as well. It's a global phenomenon, actually. When you look at the data, I have colleagues who are sort of around the world who have been studying strikes, and it's definitely just a moment for labor.
With good reason.
Yeah. And this gets back to this question about policy reform, right?
Also about the future of Section 107.
Yes. But what's really interesting here is that this worker upsurge that we're seeing across the globe in a lot of ways has not translated into political reforms. Our standard models for how politics works, if we look at sort of how modern social democracies, how modern welfare states are formed, is the role of labor mobilization is central, right? It's basically this model that, you know, workers mobilize, they have these socialist parties that bring these demands into the political realm, and governments, either out of fear or out of a desire to compromise or for whatever reason, respond with policy reforms. And then you have the creation of the modern welfare state, right? And so there's this, I guess, this idea that labor mobilization and policy reform sort of go hand in hand, and, you know, a strong political left, right?
Yeah.
That these things are really intimately tied together. And what we've seen in recent years is that these have really become unraveled, that rather we've not seen a spate of progressive policy reforms in the political realm. And we've seen the, you know, evisceration and collapse of left parties across the board. And we've seen the rise of the far right. And so we've seen this sort of interruption of that connection, if you will, or break in that connection between worker mobilization and the creation of greater political space on the left and greater policy reform. And that, for me, is sort of the central question, I think, for socialists, for sociologists of politics. It is sort of the thing that keeps me up at night these days, is trying to understand why that is. I mean, there's some obvious things to say about, you know, the collapse of social democracy and the politics of labor itself in terms of its adoption of a more sort of conservative, like a defensive stance, leading to more opportunistic forms of political engagement, which we've certainly seen at play in the U.S. and in Canada. But that's not the whole story.
But Barry, this really does beg the question. I'm dying to know, you know, because you said you stay up at night thinking about this, and you are, I guess the word isn't bi-coastal, but bi-country, you know,
bi-national,
right, that you work in Canada,
yes,
but you also live here in Los Angeles. So you have a unique perspective in a way, because you also are a labor sociologist and you know this stuff really, really well. And mm-hmm. we are now in a period, and I was going to, my next question anyway, was going to be to get you to reflect upon how, you know, this situation has diverged between U.S. and Canada, where, you know, to frame it in a way, you say in your book that policy is more favorable to collective bargaining in the United States than in Canada, but was rather, but that by the 90s that is reversed, and that in Canada it's easier to unionize than it is in the United States by far. But then, as you've just shown in this whole discussion, that labor relations also end up having a similar sort of outcome in the way that the government and the company in the state invoke this go back to work order. So the outcome of strikes is slightly different. And I wanted then, because you've mentioned, you know, that right now in the United States, we're in a very different period. We've had this period of really hot strikes and militancy and stuff going on at the Teamsters and with the writer's strike and everything else that you covered extremely well. And then, and also campus
and
workers.
The UAW.
The UAW, exactly. And UAW, not just in auto, but also in the UC student strikes. Student workers, rather, and workers. So we've had all of that, and now we've got the Trump administration that's literally just eviscerating labor by the stroke of a pen. Mm-hmm. So, and some people are saying, well, that's going to, you know, end the Wagner Act, which is the right to organize. And others are saying, well, probably a good thing because we'll go back to wildcat strikes. So, you know, I don't want necessarily to comment on that, but I want to get your thoughts about where labor is. Canada's doing all of this under a liberal government. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, we have this so-called, you know, government that bases white working class and working class voters, and it's doing everything to smash labor.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that this disruption of the connection between worker mobilization and sort of political expression is far more advanced in the U.S. than it is in Canada. It takes different appearances and it manifests itself in different ways in different countries. Yeah, I think that a lot of what we're seeing in the U.S. is symptomatic of this problem, right? That because, you know, these white workers who do support Trump, you know, who are significant parts of a lot of labor unions, the Teamsters and the UAW among them, clearly are not approaching political questions as workers, because if they were, they would sort of look at sort of, okay, Trump is eviscerating the public sector unions and is attacking worker rights and trying to dismantle the National Labor Relations Board and all this stuff. If they were acting politically as workers, they would look at this and say, that's not in my interest and I'm not going to vote for that. But they're obviously organized differently. They're organized along nativist lines or along racial lines to view, you know, so who is us and who is them, right? I mean, I think that that's like, if we think about like politics, the sort of shorthand is that it involves the drawing of dividing lines, right? The polarization along who is us and who is them. And when you're able to draw the dividing line along class lines, and, you know, we are, us is the workers and them are the bosses, that creates one set of particularly progressive possibilities, right? But then when the dividing line is, you know, whites against blacks and brown people, when it's native versus foreign born, you know, whether it's Catholic against Protestant or what have you, that significantly narrows the political sphere. And so, and you know, and parties play a key role in this, right? In organizing how people think. And of course, the fact that the Democratic Party has, you know, actively disorganized thinking along class lines for the past, you know, for a long time.
Different I mean, they don't even think about it, right? Schumer had a chance to, you know, this is on the election of the placing of people on the NLRB, and he had a chance and he, you know, forgot to bring it forward like it wasn't on his mind.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? So it's not just, you know, it is sort of completely lapsed from memory at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the it used to be at least that, you know, your Ted Kennedy liberals would, you know that, like, you know, you have to show up at the Union Hall and you have to, like, give your speech and you have to go to the Labor Day parade and what have you. And, like, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to, like, fight a back to work order or what have you. But at least it meant that, like, you understood that labor had some sort of institutional weight, had some meaning. And that kind of thing is completely gone. But I want to emphasize that this is also the case in Canada to a certain extent, right? That, you know, the NDP is a labor party in a lot more, certainly a lot more than the Democratic Party, but has really distanced itself from that history, right? Has sort of reorganized its charter to sort of, like, renegotiate its relation to the labor movement. Certain key unions like Unifor, there's a great book that I'd recommend by Stephanie Ross and Larry Savage called Shifting Gears, which is about the history of the auto union, of auto unionism in the political realm in Canada.
Wow.
That really tells this story well about this shift from sort of the NDP is the party of labor and we support them to this policy of strategic voting, right? Which led Unifor, which is the sort of a subsequent union of the Canadian auto workers, to support liberals and even in some cases conservatives in certain elections.
Boy, do we miss Ed Broadbent.
Yeah. So the NDP has sort of tried to sort of refashion itself. You know, I wouldn't say it's gone full third way Tony Blair type situation or Keir Starmer, right? But they certainly have soft pedaled the labor part of their identity. There's still a labor wing in the party, but it's not nearly as prominent as it used to be. So this sort of the role of the key thing to remember here is just the role of the party in organizing political identities and how people orient towards politics, right? And so to the extent that you're no longer really orienting people towards politics as workers, right, in a broad sense of the word, it's much harder to organize for these broader political goals, right? And it opens the door for other parties to create divisions along different lines that can be more exclusionary.
So how does that work out in Canada? Are you saying that there's other political formations perhaps to the left of the NDP? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, that's actually the sort of frustrating thing for me, you know, particularly as a professor, you know, because I get all these young people coming into my office, you know, because I teach about social movements and I teach about, you know, work and industry. And so students who are engaged and interested in, like, doing something in the world. And unfortunately, you know, for a variety of reasons, I don't quite have figured out, you know, we have not seen the same sort of resurgence of a left to the left of the NDP the way you have with DSA in the US, right? So there isn't this vibrant left ecosystem the same way you have in the US. So if a student comes to my office and wants to know, like, oh, what can I do, like, for the summer or whatever, you know, like, if I was in the US, I'd be like, hey, you can, you know, volunteer with EWOC, or you can organize workers, or you can, like, plug into this rank and file project that can, you know, help you, like, get a job, you know, or SALT someplace, or you can get involved with your local DSA chapter at home or whatever. There's none of that in Canada.
This is really interesting.
Yeah, which is really frustrating.
But, you know, there's particular reasons why we have it here and in the United States, even though, you know, I started out by saying how grim it is for labor. We've just had this really spectacular primary victory in New York with Mamdani, who kind of represents the new generation inside the Democratic Party, but also inside DSA, Democratic Socialists
Absolutely.
Of America, and who, you know, comes from Immigrant Worker Association and a history of organizing. So it's a very different kind of victory, and we don't know if it's going to be replicable across the country. We certainly hope so. But, you know, so that's the kind of backlash. And I, you know, earlier asked, is we're still talking about the air, you know, the flight attendants in Canada, Air Canada, yeah, who we don't know yet what the actual settlement's going to be, but it's a strong lesson for labor, not just in Canada, but, you know, for the U.S., I would say, too, that, it, you know, when you defy the law and really do go on strike, they rush like hell, you know, to settle because it's they don't expect it.
And the contrast is really striking, you know, when I think about sort of what's happened in Canada with the QP flight attendants or defying the back to work order and the response we've seen from labor to the federal public sector being completely dismantled, you know, unions just being completely, their collective bargaining rights being canceled, essentially. You know, it just is kind of shocking to me, the sort of almost passivity that we've seen, right? That it is really this kind of hair on fire moment for the US labor movement, and there just isn't the muscle memory, or I don't know what.
It's a good word.
To actually engage in some sort of collective action, right? I mean, it was woefully insufficient, but you just think about PATCO in 1981, and at least, you know, the AFL-CIO was able to organize like these Solidarity Day marches. Yeah. That
they hardly see that as their role anymore.
Yeah, you know.
Like, I mean, they should
able
be.
To if get I could, millions of people to the Capitol. You know.
I mean, they should be out there organizing against ICE that is raiding workplaces and, you know, shipping off workers, deporting them, and we haven't seen we've seen it locally in Los Angeles. You've seen unions fighting against that, but it should be a national response.
Yeah. No, they're just. I mean, you know. rightly respond that, you know, the AFL-CIO is a labor federation that has very little power to sort of determine what its affiliates do. Its affiliates are decentralized organizations that have, it's very hard to, you know, get them to get their locals to do things. That's all true, but it seems like there's a lot more effort that could be put into a broader political project that is mounting some sort of challenge much more concretely in terms of labor mobilization. I mean, you know, the only thing we have is, you know, we have Sean Fain's call for lining up contracts in May of 2028, right? But we're in 2025. Yeah. I'm not sure if we can wait that long. But, you know, that kind of decisive action is really necessary in to confront the political moment we're in.
It's really like, you know, we're at a crossroads, not just for the traditional liberal, you know, Democratic Party, and as you say, for parties in Canada, too, but also for the union movement and see how it moves, how it responds to the current threat, because it's very, very real. It's not the same in Canada, obviously.
No, because there is a sense in Canada, like that was the thing, right? With Air Canada, there was this knee-jerk response in Canadian labor. This is an existential moment for Canadian labor, right? That if the federal government is allowed to use Section 107 to order workers back to work every single time, that means that there is no right to strike in Canada. Matter what the Supreme Court says, it means that there is no meaningful right to strike in Canada. And so you saw, you know, the Canadian Labor Congress and all these other unions, you know, putting out statements, but also just, you know, going to the picket lines and saying to the federal government, you know, sending the clear message that this will not stand.
Okay, Barry, we've been talking a lot, I guess, globally in a sense about what's going on, but we should go back to what the QP workers at Air Canada were able to force, and what do we know about the settlement so far?
Yeah. So there hasn't been a lot about the settlement, but the details that we do know are actually, I find somewhat concerning, because the initial deal basically allows for either 60 or 70 minutes of ground pay. So the big issue in the strike was that workers, flight attendants, are only paid when the wheels are up and the air's in the plane is in the air. So all the work that goes into prepping the plane, the safety checks, the getting people boarded, dealing with ornery passengers, is all unpaid. And that was really the issue, right? That mobilized the workers, that galvanized the public. And so the settlement basically provides for, depending on the size of the aircraft, 60 or 70 minutes of paid ground time. But starting only at 50% of their hourly rate, and then going up to 70% by the end of the 4 years. So up a 5% increase in the percentage for each year. And then the other kind of problematic provision, shall we say, is that the workers that are voting on this agreement are only voting on the wage increases. Everything else, at least according to the reports that I've seen, everything else is basically baked into the tentative agreement, and the workers are signing off just on the wage increases.
So now, this isn't really a settlement then, right? This is toward a settlement.
Well, it would be the contract. I mean, it would be a contract settlement. If they vote to ratify this, then the contract would be ratified, right? And so, you know, you can view this in two ways, right? You could view this because it's obviously the workers' decision to whether or not to ratify this. I'm not trying to recommend any particular way, but we could view this in two different ways. We could view this, one, as, you know, this unpaid groundwork has been a longstanding practice in the airline industry, not just in Canada, but in the US as well. And it's maybe not something that we could have gotten rid of overnight in one contract.
Can you quickly say what that groundwork consists of?
Yeah, so that's, it's what you see flight attendants doing when you're not in the air, right? I mean, but it's making sure the equipment's functional. It's making sure that it's providing the, you know, safety briefings for passengers. It's getting everybody on board. It's getting all the luggage stowed. It's getting, you know, making
sure people. So that's not paid.
You know, and all of that is unpaid, right? So they're in their uniforms. They're taking care of passengers. They're you know, giving safety briefings, they're not getting paid, right? So, and this has gone on for years, for decades, right? And, you know, it used to be, I guess, the rationale behind this, to the extent that there is a rationale that you should not pay people for work, is that the hourly rate in the air was large enough that it would make up for the portion of unpaid work, right? That was sort of the justification. But that hourly rate in the air has eroded over time, while the amount of groundwork has increased because airlines have leaned out their staff, leading to increases in flight delays, which many listeners are probably all too familiar with. And so when you have those flight delays and you're dealing with ornery passengers who can't get who are missing their connecting flight or can't get to their cousin's wedding or what have you, and they're yelling at you, and they are very likely, depending on the delay, going to get some sort of compensation for their trouble. But meanwhile, the flight attendants are not getting paid, right? And so the hourly rate has eroded, the groundwork has increased, so the situation had become untenable for flight attendants. And so that was why, so QP was basically making it like, this is we're taking a stand, we're going to get rid of this. And so we could say, I mean, you know, so I guess the charitable argument is that, you know, this is a longstanding practice in the airline industry. It's not something we can resolve overnight in one contract. But then the other side is that, you know, if you're making this a moral issue, right? You know, how can you tolerate, you know, if we're saying unpaid work is unacceptable, then like, why is it acceptable at 50%, right? That some of your work is paid at one rate and some of your work is paid at another rate. That also is unfair, right? And you could certainly see how flight attendants who have just been through these months of negotiations, who have been through this strike, who have collectively defied a back to work order, might look at this and think to themselves, well, why did we fight for all this only to come up short, right? And this, you know, to think more broadly, would be in keeping with a pattern that we've seen a lot in Canada. I don't, there's no clear way of measuring this, but it seems to be more a thing in Canada than in the US, which is workers rejecting contracts. I think there's been a one of the parts, it's not just that workers have been going on strike in recent years, but they have been pushing back against contract settlements. And it's often not because they're sellout agreements, right? So you definitely had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, workers voting down contracts because they had all sorts of concessions in them. But rather what we see is that they are voting them down because they're not good enough. They do not meet workers' heightened expectations. And I would think that an experience like what the QP flight attendants have been through would have the effect of dramatically heightening their expectations of what they're capable of and what they're entitled to. And so, we'll have to wait for the vote, but it's to me does not seem at all clear that this is a slam dunk.
So really, I'm really glad that you brought that out, Barry, because it seems like we've had this incredible flexing of workers' muscle mm-hmm. that had immediate effect, but now we have to see whether or not they'll either threaten to go back out or just not vote for the agreement. So it's not settled.
Absolutely not.
We'll bring you back for more as yes. as we find out. Thanks for that, Barry. I can't thank you enough for that. We've run out of time, Barry, but you've helped us understand not just the Air Canada strike and what it means for labor in Canada and workers' rights and even the balance of power and collective bargaining, but across the border in the U.S. as well. Just to encourage the listeners, you can still pick up Barry's 2019 book called Labor and the Class Idea in the U.S. and Canada because it explores all of this. What?
2018.
Yes. Okay. But it explores all of these themes in greater depth. And then pick up as well the recent Globe and Mail op-ed that puts this strike in historical perspective. Thanks so much for joining us today, Barry.
Oh, it's my pleasure always. Thanks, Susie.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Barry Idlin. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Aussie Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. There's more information on programs and guests on our Facebook page, and that's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
As the go-to media outlet for Southern California progressive thinkers since 1959, KPFK is very proud of its legacy. But maintaining that legacy can be expensive. Become part of the KPFK community today by donating at kpfk.org. Just click on the Support KPFK button on the website to send your gift today. Because while ignorance can be costly, speaking truth to power is priceless.
This is Stephanie Wells, Executive Director of Pacifica Foundation. Congress has defunded public media, threatening the survival of television and radio stations that provide trusted news, emergency alerts, and vital community connection. Years of corporate media consolidation and deregulation have taken media out of community hands, while social media platforms cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Greetings. Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
Hi, I'm John Santana, host of Cinema Score, where we play music of the movies, stage, and TV. And next time on the program, we'll bring you music composed to accompany a huge puppet show, which depicted the history of medicine and was presented at the Hall of Pharmacy at the 1939 World's Fair, that music composed by none other than Aaron Copland. Sunday,